have anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I can just be blunt and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Ahoy, friends. Thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. I'm Zach Weaver, and you are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 15, Episode 1, Hear Me. We kicked off this season with a quick history lesson on the city of Benton Harbor, its community, and its recent history of violence. We have a lot to discuss this week, from Angelique Bell's interview about her own son Richard Perry's tragic death, to the tragic death of DeMario Lowe's, and the possible wrongful conviction of Jody Hill. We have a lot of listener questions, and Bob, Janet, and I are here to answer them all. Welcome to Season 15.
Thank you, Zach, and thanks, Janet, for joining us. Before we get started, we have so many questions today, so we're going to try to get through stuff relatively quickly today. I do want to talk about a few things right up front, though, before we get going too far. First of all, I want to do a big shout-out and thank you to some of our friends that are other content creators that have helped us get the word out with this story in this episode. Those of you that subscribe to several other true crime podcasts, you probably have seen this episode popping up all over the place. And it wasn't a marketing thing. It's literally in 15 seasons of doing this. We've done it for people, but I have never, ever asked someone to do it. When we finished this episode this week and we finally listened to it and I sent it to a couple of folks to listen to it, the overwhelming feeling was like more people need to hear this. We need more ears on this. And listen, we genuinely have a big fight on our hands right now. And we have a lot of work to do with Jody's case and with several other cases through the city of Benton Harbor, which I know there's some confusion about that. We'll be talking about that in a little bit. But there's a reason behind everything that we're doing. And I just wanted as many ears on this as possible. So for the first time in 15 seasons, I reached out to some of our friends who I know that are very dedicated to advocating for victims and are in the space because they want to make a genuine difference, and asked them if they would be willing to share the episode on their feed just to get more ears on, if nothing else. If the only thing that happens is that people listen to that episode, then great. At least they heard that story. At least Angelique's story and Richard Perry's story is going to be heard by so many people. So I reached out to a few of my podcaster friends, 100% of them. I mean, it really touched my heart. Everybody jumped at the opportunity to do it. So I just want to give a quick shout out just before we started this episode today, where we started recording, our friend Josh Hallmark, a True Crime Bullshit, just published the episode on his feed. Our friends Dr. Scott and Dr. Shiloh at LA Not So Confidential dropped it on their feed. Robbie and Colin dropped a preview version of it on the Undisclosed feed. Jim Clementi dropped it on both Real Crime Profile and on Best Case, Worst Case. And Jillian Pensavalli and Patrick Hines and True Crime Obsessed are dropping it, I believe, today, which is Wednesday we're recording this. They're dropping it on that feed. And you guys got to understand that doing a feed drop like that is a form of advertising. And it is very expensive. It is the most expensive form of advertising, particularly on a show like True Crime Obsessed that has, you know, listeners in the millions. That is, you know, that's a lot of money that could have been received to have a feed drop like that. Every single one of these shows did it absolutely free, didn't ask for anything in return, and also not a second's hesitation by any of them. Nobody wanted to negotiate and figure it out. So I just want to shout out all those shows that were willing to do that and did it for us. It means the world to me. I know that it means the world to Angelique. She called me on Sunday, was just over the moon about we text on Sunday, over the moon about the episode. She said we were a blessing from God, which is amazing to hear from her. And then she called me yesterday, just bursting at the seams. Bunch of people in the community have been listening to it and have come to her and asked her to put them in contact with me because they have stories to tell and they want help. I know there was some people, a small handful of people that, you know, made posts like, well, I just want to talk about our wrongful conviction. I don't want to talk about all this other stuff. It's, why are we talking about the community and the history? Listen, in a case like this, it's going to take the community to help us solve the case. And this is a community that has a hard time trusting anyone because no one has given them a reason to trust them. So it was very important to me to earn that trust when I told Angelique that I would tell her son's story, that we told that story. And as I said in the episodes leading, if you're new to this season, we talked about leading up to this, that this has become a much bigger case than I thought. It's not just this wrongful conviction case. The community in Benton Harbor, they need help. They need change. And it's going to take outside influence to help them get that change. It's going to take attention from more people than just them in the community to get that change. And that's very important to me. So I want to just tell you right now, up front, as we start this season, if you're coming along this ride with us and you're going to work with us, that's what we're working for. We are working to overturn what I believe is the wrongful conviction of Jody Hill. We're working to try to find the killer of DeMario Lowe's. And we are working to help the people in the community of Benton Harbor and to effect real change. That's the mission this season. It's not just the one wrongful conviction. So if you don't want, if you only want to focus on just one thing, then you're probably going to be disappointed because we're going to be moving along. You know, that this episode was what the show always is we investigate for a week and then we tell the narrative on Sunday about what happened that week. And as soon as Erica and I got into the city of Benton Harbor and started talking to the people in the community, the first question that came to both of us was, how did this happen? How did we get here? And so we decided, let's go find out how we got here. That's part of our investigation, is to understand it's part of the victimology. That's why you heard the history lesson at the beginning, because that's what I was doing, because I wanted to understand. Erica wanted to understand how we got here. And I think it's a critical element of that. So just letting you guys know that's where we're going. Big thank you to all those content creators who have gone above and beyond to help get this message out. It means the world to me. It means the world to me that all of you are listening and are engaged. And I can tell you from firsthand, from talking to Angelique, that she and the people in that community are already just so grateful that someone's listening to, somebody's hearing them. So thank you for that. Last little note before we get into the rest of the content. I want to talk just for a little bit. I mentioned in the episode, that Jody is a trans woman in prison, and that there's going to be some confusion sometimes because we have, you know, all these case documents and reports and trial testimony for a Joseph Hill, and currently we have Jody Hill. So, you know, that was even for this episode, I'll tell you, it was tough. Like, Eric and I had a lot of conversation about that. Like, how are we going to handle this? And what you heard is what we came up with was, let's just explain up front. There's some confusion because of this, but Joseph is now Jody. And from here on out, this is Jody when we talk about the case. I was able to actually speak to Jody twice this week. I'm gonna speak to them again later this afternoon. In that conversation, I was wrong about how we even addressed Jody in this episode. Based on the information that I had gotten from people that brought the case to me, that Jody is trans and uses she, her pronouns. I asked Jody when we had him on the phone, and they said that they actually consider themselves more non-binary and prefer they, them pronouns. So this is the thing that I want to tell you guys. We as a team, me, Erica, Zach, Janet, are going to be doing our very best to be respectful of that. Not just to Jody, but of other people in the LGBTQ plus community. I can also tell you we're probably going to make mistakes along the way. So I want to address that up front. Particularly, I can tell you, speaking for me personally, the they, them pronouns are tricky for me. It's hard for my brain. It's easy if I'm writing a script, but when I'm speaking like this right now, it's difficult for my brain to switch that pronoun. I'm working on it. I'm trying. I'm trying to make sure that I get it right. All of us are. All of you know, the three of us, and you're getting to know Erica, all of us you know that we would never, ever do anything to hurt someone's feelings, to make someone feel bad, or to offend anyone. So with that being said, if and when we make mistakes regarding how we use the verbiage, pronouns, anything like that along the way, feel free to let us know that we need to correct those. But do that through an email, through a DM, through a private message. What I don't want to happen, what's not going to be allowed to happen, is for, on like the fan page and the discussion groups, for this to turn into a big argument and fight on the public page where we're supposed to be investigating and discussing the case about a mistake like that that we made. So those posts aren't going to be allowed on the page, because you can just reach out to us. If we've made a mistake, we'll correct it. That's how that's going to be handled. It's not going to be. And the reason for it is we have so much work to do. And that discussion will distract away from the work that we're doing, when really all that needs to happen is we need to be made aware of our mistakes so that we can correct them along the way. So I hope that we can all agree that that's how we're going to handle this situation going forward. I also want to point out that Jody is not offended by any of it. Literally, when I talked to Jody, Eric and I both were on the phone with them yesterday, and you know, we discussed this, and they said, it's not important to me. Like, it's important to me that you're telling my story. It's not important to me if you get a pronoun wrong here, there. And I told them, I said, but I want to do it the way you prefer. So you tell me what you prefer, and that's what we're going to do. But Jody wanted to make clear that they don't want people distracted arguing about a pronoun. They want people to be focused on the case. Just wanted to put that out there ahead of time. Just let you know, I'm sure I'm going to make mistakes. Zach's going to make mistakes. Janet's going to make mistakes along the way. But we're doing our best, and hopefully everybody can respect that. With that being said, we can get started. I guess I'll respond real quick. So Chris in the chat just said, so it's always Jody, not Joseph, when talking about the crime. Chris, that's hard for me. I think that what we landed on is the best way for us to handle it is just to always refer to them as Jody, unless we're directly quoting something. But that's hard. I mean, if you really stop and think back, or think about trying to tell a story where the person in the current context is non-binary, they, them, but in the context of everything that you're referencing was he, him, and Joseph, it's difficult. That's why I'm telling you there's going to be mistakes. In this episode this week, we put it out and sent it to Janet to review it. And we did. I think three times where we made mistakes in there that we were able to edit and fix before we put it out. So just know that we're going to do our best, and that's not the place where we need to get distracted. Okay, correct us privately. Let's not distract from the overall picture. If you've been struggling with your fitness goals, particularly, I can speak from my own experience, if you're over 40 years old and you're really starting to struggle, the things you used to do don't work anymore, you need to listen up. First Form is the real deal. I'm telling you from personal experience, I personally know at least 6 different people that all were struggling with weight loss and fitness goals. All of them started using the First Form app and products, and every single one of them lost a significant amount of weight, got into great shape, and the most important part, they've continued to stay in that great shape for over a year. It's a real solution for real long-term goals. They have lots of products. I've talked about many of them before. I use a lot of them daily. I wake up every morning to a shake that I make with my OptiGreens and the First Form protein powder. That's my breakfast every single morning, along with my MicroFactor daily nutrition packet. But really what I want to tell you about today is the app, because the app is what made the biggest difference for me and got me started on my goals, and I use the First Form products to help me along that journey. With the app, you set up all your information, you set your goals, it tells you how many calories you should eat every day. The app also then breaks down what macros you should eat to get to that calorie level, and it's mostly about making the majority of your calories come from protein. I've been using the First Form app for 1.5 years. I've lost over 70 pounds. My wife's lost over 35 pounds. Zach's wife's lost over 60 pounds. And throughout that whole time, the 1.5 years that I've been using First Form, I've never been hungry. It's plenty of food, and you can eat anywhere. When you're using the app, you can go out to dinner. The key is planning and tracking and paying attention and being mindful about what you eat. I am personally endorsing and telling you that based on my experience and every other person that I know's experience, if you're struggling right now and you feel like the things you did in your 20s aren't working anymore in your 40s, if you use First Form, you will see long-term sustainable results. And like I said, the app is the biggest part of that for me, but I use a ton of their products to help me along the way. And First Form has set up a special link just for my listeners to go get those products with free shipping. If you go to firstform.com/truth, any order over $75, you get free shipping with it. Now that's firstform, the number one, firstform.com/truth to get the free shipping. But also, if you order products using that link and you're a new customer, they're going to give you a month to try the app for free. So go on, get you some energy drinks or protein shake or some greens or their meat sticks, which are delicious. Or my personal favorite, their protein bars. Just go load up on some of that stuff. They're going to give you the app free. You can try it out. You can see the results for yourself. And if you're not happy with the products that you get, they have a 110% money back guarantee. So there's no risk at all. They have that 110% money back guarantee on their products. If you order over $75 worth, those products ship for free. And if you're a new customer, they're going to give you a month to try the app for free. So I'm serious. If you're struggling, try it out. Go to firstform.com/truth. Guys, thoughts on episode one?
I'm all in, buddy. I'm all in. I think I speak for many people who made comments on the Facebook page or on social media or just in these chats that we've been having today in our pre-show and right now. I'm really excited that it's about more than Jody. And I hope that Jody is excited about that too, in the sense that, you know, a lot of people that we talk to and a lot of people that we talk about when we're talking about wrongful convictions, I'm very emotional about all of this, by the way, in a great way. But talk about, you know, Carrie, Max Cook, like having an impact that is greater than just your situation is such an exciting and beautiful gift to get on top of and to be able to give on top of all of the hardship that you have gone through. So I think I just want to piggyback on what you were saying earlier about context and say, let's not take this away from either the community or from the case or from Jody, because to feel like you're helping impact change when you're behind bars and shouldn't be is another layer of, oh my God, this means something. Maybe I can help. Maybe this thing that happened to me is going to make it better for people in the future. You know, we've talked about, certainly that's very important to Adnan. So I think it's so exciting to talk about and think about and help impact something going forward that is bigger than just this one thing. It's huge, and it's really, really cool. And I think it's going to be hard and frustrating because it means that we're going to be looking at those big pictures. And sometimes that can feel overwhelming and feel daunting. And maybe that's what sometimes people are responding to, is this feeling of like, oh, if we can just have this one thing we're working on, it won't feel so overwhelming because it can be discouraging. But we don't have that luxury. That's not the world that we're living in. And so I loved the context. I loved the conversations with Angelique and feeling like we got to be inside of those. I'm so happy that she's feeling, you know, buoyed by that and that the community's feeling good. Let's do it. Let's go. I can't wait.
I'll tell you, for me, I mean, I grew up here. I know it. I worked downtown Benton Harbor. I worked three blocks from where this murder was committed for years. From 2001 to 2005, I worked three blocks from where this murder was committed. Mm-hmm. I worked there during there was riots in 2003. I worked there during all of that. Like, I'm very familiar with this. But the history, learning the true history, I think that was really interesting because I didn't know a lot of that. I've heard from my grandfather grew up here. And has told me that several times that growing up, like Benton Harbor was, that's where you went when you were here.
Yeah.
So I knew that was it, but I didn't understand quite how it had changed. And I think a big thing I took away from this episode is in Angelique's conversation, she said it, but she said it without really like explaining it. But I think the biggest issue we're going to come across, and you talked about this, is helping this community move forward. because there's going to be a lot of answers that this community actually has, but they're too afraid to come forward because of the violence. So there's going to be, the truth is out there and somebody knows the truth and the answers are out there and we could find the answers, but we have to build that trust, not only with us, but with the community, with the policing, I mean, everything. Like, because those answers are there. I mean, Angelique said in her interview that the neighbor knew who did, who was part of this one murder, and but she was too afraid for her own children. So the answers are out there. We can find these answers. We can help everybody. This is going to be a large undertaking, but I'm here for it.
And I want to shout out Aaron really quick in the chat, because I was just about to say almost the exact same thing. Aaron says, this history reminds me of so many cities, particularly after the 1960s riots. That's the other thing is, you know, we're giving this really specific context to this community and this environment in these two cities that you guys know so well, but so many of us are hearing echoes of communities that we know or that we have heard about or that have been discussed in the media or that have been discussed through history. This is a problem that happens everywhere in one form or other. So it feels so familiar, even though we're talking about a very specific location. So I think that's such a great point, Aaron, and also Zach. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Chuck touched on that in this situation, in a lot of cities, it's a part of town, not a separate city. Mm-hmm. But really, to me, it was just fascinating to really break down like the why, like how did we get there? Because it is looked at, and you know this, Zach, from being here, like people look at Benton Harbor, it's like, oh, those people, they're just violent. And it's because if you like back up and realize what really happened, it was incredibly eye-opening to me. It's like one of those things you like are behind, like you get behind and support, but don't really understand why. Trying to Black Lives Matter and all the different movements that come along with that, but you don't understand but how did this happen? And I think there's an ideology that all of these people of color in these communities did this to themselves, and that is not the case. Like you heard, and again, like if anybody didn't like the history lesson, you needed it, and if it made you uncomfortable, good, it was supposed to. That was the point. It is not their fault. Any people that live that are in these communities, it was literally like if you were to back up and like try to set up a chess match, how to checkmate somebody into that position, that's what happened. Mm. You know, you drew them up. They couldn't own the property that they were living in. They're renting from all of the white people that are making more money from them. They're given extremely low paying jobs, and then the white people just beat it, and they're just stuck. They can't get out, and then in a lot of cases, particularly in Benton Harbor, it seems that there is then, you add to that, the police force doesn't seem to care. The city management doesn't seem to care about them and isn't policing them. One of the things that I was the most, I guess, proud of when I wrote this piece of it, but it was when it occurred to me when I was hearing Angelique say that everybody has to police themselves and they all have guns. If there was ever an instance for you to understand that this has nothing to do with race, was the reference back to the old American West. Because it's literally the exact same thing. A bunch of white people in the American West all were carrying guns and were all shooting each other and violence was running rampant, had nothing to do with the color of their skin and everything to do with a lack of policing and a lack of a government that was protecting people, so they had to protect themselves. So that's important to keep in mind. Like, that's how this situation kind of got created. With that being said, I mean, I'm already rambling for 15, 20 minutes.
Let me go back to one thing really quick. And for those that don't understand, you know, Chuck said that typically it's part of town, but this is a separate town. What people outside the area don't realize is that this should be one town. For any good reason, this should be one town. If you look at it, it's one town. There just happens to be a river that divides it. And on one half is this and one half is the other. But it's everything that, if you see any of it, it's one town. Mm-hmm. They call it the Twin Cities. It's one town. It's not a part of town. It's not a separate town. It is all one town. It just happens to be divided by a river.
All right. And with that being said, we need to get into these questions. We're already rambling for 20 minutes and we haven't even, and I know we've got a ton of questions, so we're going to get through as many of them as we can.
So I would love to just see how you want to address, you know, well, first of all, I want to say there were so many positive comments about, you know, getting a chance to hear Erica and just the production and the music and, you know, shout outs to the students and all of that. So lots of positive feedback there. There was a little bit of confusion, I think, for some folks because we were kind of talking about two different stories, in a sense, and along with all of this, the big contextual stuff. So folks like Jess and Crystal Sue, Robert, they just found themselves wanting to, I guess, make sure that they were not getting confused between Angelique's son, Richard, and between and then talking about the actual case that we're addressing long term that yeah. Jody is incarcerated because of. So do you want to just very quickly kind of outline that?
Yeah. So and that'll become more clear this week with episode two is all Jody's case. And DeMario Lowe is the victim in that case. It was a bit confusing, I would say. I mean, it's worth a re-listen, I think, if you were a little confused by it, because it seemed like it was broken because it was basically we write in three acts. The first act was the history. The second act was Angelique's story about Richard. And then the third act was a quick summary of the murder of DeMario Lowe's, which is the main case that we're going to be focusing on. But also understand there was purpose behind that. We just talked about the purpose of the history, but there was also purpose in telling Richard's story because it all has to do with victimology, right? So it's all about how do we, that's what victimology is, right? What set of circumstances put a victim in a position where this could happen to them? So Angelique's story about Richard served two purposes. One, it was the promise to share his story and hopefully be able to do something about it. The other element is the lack of policing and the lack of trust that the community has in the police force. And rather than me just telling you that, you were able to hear it in a real life context, right? So there was purpose in that too. It was very nothing. Somebody made a post that said you need to think before you speak, Bob. You have no idea how much I think before I speak. Like nothing, not a single word in that episode between me and Erica putting it together was not on purpose. Every single word of it was on purpose, and so that was part of it. So yeah, our main case is the murder of DeMario Lowe's and the wrongful conviction of Jody Hill. There's going to be more of this as we go. Like I said, when Angelique called me on Monday, you know, she told me that there's all these people in the community that want to talk to us that also want help. So we're going to be kind of where it's appropriate, peppering those stories in through. There's one in particular that tugs at my heartstrings. A few years ago, there was the police shot and killed a black man in Benton Harbor. He was a former student of mine and Becky's. Mm-hmm. Like we both taught at. You guys know that I used to substitute teach and Becky taught for years at a school for emotionally impaired kids. And this was, I still remember that day, like watching on the news, like this happened. And then they said the name and it was just like, both of us just crying. It's going to get me again here. But it was like, we saw the name and we knew him. His mother reached out and wants to speak with us. So we're going to hear from, I'm going to go tomorrow, actually on the 4th of July, where people are off work. Erica and I are heading back there to talk to several people. She's one of them. And those stories we need, but because there's also another thing that I've just learned from Angelique and then some of the other folks that we've heard about. A lot of these people don't have heads. Richard doesn't have a headstone. Mm-hmm. Like they can't afford headstones. And I think that's something that we can help with. I know Angelique said that they've been working on trying to put together a fundraiser so they can afford to get a headstone for Richard. And you know, when the information comes out, I think that that's something that we can help with.
One thing that I think people could go back and listen to is when they hear Angelique's story, you have to realize that is a huge part of victimology because you understand how rampant the violence is. And the reason I say this is if you don't realize it, if you go back and listen, Bob spoke to a random person on the street. He didn't go seek Angelique out. He spoke to a random person on the street about Jody's case and this came out.
Yeah.
That is something that you guys must understand that this is also
the first person I spoke to. That was the first person I spoke to on the street. You know, just in the community, walked up just to ask a question. And that, I mean, there's so much of it.
Yes.
That these stories need to be told.
I'm trying to figure out where to jump around because I know we're not going to get to all of this. And I sort of had like a map of or the way I organize the questions, but there's just so much. And I think apologies to those of you whose questions we don't cover. I think a lot of them, you know, this has happened before in past seasons. It's our first episode of a new season and everyone is so excited to jump in and it's bringing up so many questions already. And the good news about that is I think many of those questions will be, you know, the answers will reveal themselves as we go through the season. But it's so hard because we all want all of the answers now. And that's a good thing. That just means everybody's engaged. So apologies that we can't cover everything. But again, I think these are all such great, thoughtful questions that point in the direction that we're going, that we'll get there one way or the other. So we really appreciate all of those great questions. This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Alexa says, typically when you start a new season, you say that the case at hand might be a wrongful conviction and that you decided to take the case because there are a few indicators that a wrongful conviction is at play. In this episode, it seems like you're already convinced it's definitely a wrongful conviction. Can you share the key elements of the case that convinced you that we're definitely dealing with a wrongful conviction here?
So I'm not going to give you those elements yet. But what I'll tell you is it is different because we always do some pre-work, obviously, some interviews and stuff before we start launching the season. In this case, immediately, like evidence started being revealed that made me 100% sure that this is a wrongful conviction. So that was not the intention. Part of it is because it's local, I'm able to like anytime I want, get in the car and drive over and talk to people and interview people and knock on doors. Yeah, that evidence will be revealed, but it's not that I've just like changed the way I do things and now I'm just going to declare something a wrongful conviction before we start. It's because like, you know, I didn't expect that, but you start, you interview people and like, oh, okay, well that was, and also, by the way, that's part of what's so frustrating about the whole situation is it's that easy.
Right.
It was that easy.
Yes.
For me to go knock on two doors and figure out that they got the wrong person. And Jody's been in prison for 23 years. Oof.
Well, we've also gotten a lot of questions about, you know, as we're talking about the context, as we're talking about the makeup of the cities, questions have come up about, you know, I'll read Karen's to kind of represent everybody. But Karen says, do you have any statistical information about the makeup of the Benton Harbor Police Department, specifically race and if they actually live in the city or commute from the surrounding area? If not, can you give your perception of the racial makeup based on your experiences with them? So yeah, that's, you know, Christy wanted to know, like, is Dan McGinnis white? What about the mayor? So we're still talking, yes, we're talking about poverty, but we also are talking about the potential for, you know, racism as attached to assumptions about people in poverty and all of those other factors. So do you feel like that plays a part in this? And what is the makeup of the police department, if you have a sense of that, in Benton Harbor?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And as you heard me say in the episode, this is not a race thing at all. I mean, there are racial elements that are built into it, particularly in like the setup of it and how we got to where we are. McGinnis, and by the way, I keep calling him police chief. Just to be clear, his actual title is director of public safety in Benton Harbor. Benton Harbor is a combined police fire department. He was on the police side and then became the director of public safety. And then there's like a deputy director of police, a deputy director of fire, just to be clear about that. But Dan McGinnis is black. Several of the officers are black. The entire city council is black. So in the city council, they have to live in the city, I imagine, in order to be on the city council. I don't have the statistics, but yeah, that's what's been vocalized to me. That's one of the things that people feel kind of so betrayed about that live in the community. They're these are people of color. Some from our community that are just like have like separated themselves from us, you know. So it's not a racial thing. You don't have a bunch of white politicians and white police officers that are ignoring the black community. You have black police officers, black police chief, public safety director, black city council, mayor, city manager, ignoring the people in the community the way they feel. And again, like there are some people that took issue with me too, like on social media about, you know, me saying that, you know, because of the fact that they're all black, that, you know, I'm not saying anything. That was the other reason you heard from Angelique. I'm telling you and letting them tell you, let the people in the community share how they feel. And I'm sure that people in the city government and Dan McGinnis and people are listening to this and they're probably real mad. Instead of being mad, hear me. This is how the people in your community feel. I'm not making this up. This is not my story.
Well, look, if the opportunity arises for someone who's on that city council to come and talk about their perspective and whether they feel like they're, you know, an ER nurse in a triage situation where there's just so much, there's only so much we can even do anymore. Like, how people are welcome to, you've always been very open about that. Come tell us what your experience of being a leader in that community is.
I've reached out to them. I've emailed all of them.
Let's hear what it's like. But let's hear each other. And certainly, this community is the priority.
And anybody that is listening from the city government, from the police force, I want you to know it's not my intention for this to be a fight between me and you. It is not my intention for this to be a fight between the community and you. My intention is to fix the problem. My intention is to work together. That was my intention for those of you that have ignored my emails from the beginning. My intention is to build the community, build the trust, find a way to work together to correct the situation. So if you're sitting back right now trying to think what your next move in this fight is, how about instead of that, give me a call, respond to my email, and let's do something to try to fix this.
Also, a lot of questions around Jody's transition. I don't know how deeply you want to get into that, but there are people, let me put it this way. There are people who are concerned about Jody's safety. They're concerned about what Jody's living situation is currently in terms of how they identify and where they are placed, where they're incarcerated. Can you speak to any of that? I'm sure we'll be digging deeper into it soon, but is there anything you can kind of lay the groundwork for here?
Yeah, I'm going to let Jody explain that. I spoke with Jody about that yesterday, day before yesterday, and actually recorded an interview, about 10 minutes and let them explain that. So that's I don't think it'll come in this week's. I don't think it's an appropriate fit for this week's episode, but probably next week that stuff will come out. So rather than me try to articulate it to you here, we're going to let Jody tell you themselves.
Great. Okay. Well, for those of you who posted a question about that or something related to that, then know that. And I appreciate so much the questions and the compassion and the thoughtfulness that you had around all of that. We will definitely dig into that. There are certainly questions that people have had about Angelique's son, Richard, about that case. They, of course, are interested in that, want more information, want to try to be able to help with that as well. Is that something that you want us to kind of start digging into in some way in conversation or otherwise? Are there clarifications that we can make now, or is that, again, to come?
Well, I think we're going to need to put some pressure on the powers that be to move that case forward, but I don't want to do that yet because there's a new prosecutor that Angelique mentioned, Amy Byrd. I want to make contact with Ms. Byrd about the case and see where we're at. And I'm hoping that this can be a situation where we don't have to put a bunch of pressure on them to get this forward, because I don't know anything about her. So I'm going to have that conversation. And also it should be pointed out too that, and I don't know why, but I'm also going to reach out to the detective in charge, because this case is the main investigator in this case is now someone in the state police. It's not somebody in the city of Benton Harbor, which I don't quite understand why, the Benton Harbor has their own detective branch that handles, or, detectives that handle this stuff, why it got punted out to the state police. So I need to figure that out, but also I want to make contact with the detective in charge, at least attempt to make contact with the detective in charge at the state police level to see if we can move things forward for Angelique. So before we do anything, as a group, as a whole, as the Truth and Justice Army, I want to start making some phone calls and sending some emails to see where we're at with that.
Okay, thanks for that. Just one quick clarification about documents. Sarah said, hopefully I'm not jumping ahead here, but have you been expressly denied rights to any specific records other than being ignored or simply not receiving them? And if so, did they provide a code? Are they backed by the law? So could you just remind us, I know you said it in the episode, but you have made requests, and it isn't that someone said you absolutely are not getting these. It's been more vague than that, right?
It's complicated. It's actually, so the final segment of the episode that's coming Sunday, I'm going to kind of break that down because it'll take too long for me to do it here. As you heard Erica at the beginning, and some people asked, yes, that was Erica's voice at the beginning of the episode. So you started the season hearing her lovely voice. That after we finished production and I had, we talked about how nobody responded to my emails, McGinnis did respond to my email, and it was in regards to this. So what had happened up to that point was, no, they haven't denied me access. Essentially, they've said, sure, you can have everything we have, but the previous chief shredded the file. We're looking for a backup. And then they're like, oh, we found the backup. Here you go. Here's everything we have. And then it's been me saying, okay, but where's this, 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 and this? Like, I know these things exist. They were entered as exhibits at trial. We went to the prosecutor's office, and our prosecutor's office, their process is after the trial, they send those things back to the agency. So they're like, no, Benton Harbor Police received all these items on this date when they were all sent back to them. Back to Benton Harbor, say, okay, you have them. Where are these items? And they claim they don't have them, which is what, you know, I had said back, you know, prior to the season starting, like, this is going to be trouble. It's frustrating in a lot of ways. I believe very strongly that this conviction is going to get overturned. And you've never heard me say that before. I believe very strongly, based on what I've just already discovered, I think this conviction is going to get overturned. I think for sure Jody Hill was wrongfully convicted. I think we already have the evidence. And I'm sure, and I think, and we're building that there's going to be even more. And I think that this conviction is going to overturn. But then where is the justice for DeMario Lowe's? Because according to the Benton Harbor Police Department, they don't have a single crime scene photo. None. They don't have a single recording of any of the interviews they did. They don't have a transcript of the interviews that they did. How are they going to try? They don't have the dispatch log to even know what time the crime was committed. How are they going to then try someone new for this? It's one thing, like, how are you going to defend, you know, an appeal, a writ in court without that stuff? But then if the conviction gets overturned, now what? So I don't know. We're working through all that. I'll talk about it a little bit more on Sunday, because there's also a pretty big development on that side of it too.
Oh, okay. Some folks curious about, you know, you name dropped Ravia. I know that that was something that this is something that she brought to you. People are wondering if there's more to it than that. Like, just what's her connection? Is this just something that was brought to her attention by a different individual or a different group? And she, you know, came through and she knew that she couldn't take it on. She gave it to you. Is it as simple as that?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I believe the process was, there's an advocate that's been advocating for Jody for some time, named Jacqueline. Well, you met Jacqueline.
Yep.
Cause she brought a box of files. Zach met her to get a box of files from her. I think she had sent the case to Rabia, had listed undisclosed, thought she could help, send it to Rabia. Rabia spent some time looking at it. And really what happened, Rabia listens to our show. And she had heard me back in December, January, saying the case that we were going to be doing fell through. You know, I'm going to be going back through the case files and submissions, see if we can find another case. And she was like, hey, I've been trying to get to this one for 2 years. I think this is a wrongful conviction and it really needs a boots on the ground investigation. Like, Robbie had even at one point sent a PI to Benton Harbor to try to work on it. And so she sent me the case file again, having no idea. When I told her, when she sent it to me and I was like, Robbie, this is in my backyard. And her response was, oh, I forgot you lived in Michigan. So she didn't even know it was in the same state. Mm-hmm. Like, I live in this county.
Yeah.
Like, I live right here. So it was just, you know, sheer happenstance, fate, whatever you believe, that this ended up in my lap.
Yeah. Well, and that sort of brings back up, you know, there were a few people who brought that up again, this idea of it being so close to home. You know, Ashton says, because of the case being so close to you and they know you're doing it, are you nervous that they're going to try to make it as difficult as possible? And Jesse had a similar question, was wondering if this was something that came as a surprise to you or if there was a sense of like, oh, I think you mentioned something about this. I can't remember if it was in a pre-show or not, but this idea of like, I know some of these people, and was it surprising to hear this or was it like, oh, like, this makes sense.
It was kind of the latter. You know, when I saw some of the names on the police reports and just from, you know, experience, knowing some of the things that I know from just the scuttlebutt you get cause from working in public safety in the same county, I was not surprised that this could be a potential. I mean, we had Andrew Collins on the show a couple of years ago. He was a Benton Harbor police officer who was caught planting evidence and doing all kinds of stuff and ended up going to prison for it. And he came on and shared his story about how that happened. That was around this time. Mm-hmm. So the idea that there was something was done wrong here and that this was a wrongful conviction, like the fact that that may be possible certainly wasn't surprising to me at all. It being close to home, there's good and bad to it. I mean, the good part is we're up there all the time. Like, you know, because we have days where we strike out. There are Eric and I just on Monday, we made a trip to go find somebody and got there. And like the address we had was just wrong. Like, nope, that's not who lives there. Never heard of that person. And we struck out. Janet, you've been with me when I'm traveling out in the field. And in those cases, when that happens, it's devastating. You know, you spend thousands of dollars traveling somewhere and you got a couple of days to work and you dedicate a bunch of time to go do something and then you crap out on it. You burned a day. So the nice part of being local is like we were frustrated for a minute, but it's like, all right, well, let's just head back to the office. We'll regroup and then we'll hit it again on Thursday. We'll go back out again on Thursday. That's nice. It is a little unnerving, I think, that it's local based on, you'll hear the email on Sunday, but based on the email I got from the police chief, he's not a fan. And certainly I'm sure he has contact, you know, police contact. But the good part about it is too, I also have a lot of good contacts with law enforcement. I have good relationships with a lot of law enforcement in this county. So I'd like to hope nothing underhanded would happen because of that. But it's something that I is in the back of my mind at all times, for sure.
Yeah. Well, oftentimes people say, you know, as long as there's a possibility of that, it's better that, you know, tens to hundreds of thousands of people are listening, because it's not, you're not doing it in the shadows. So it makes it a lot harder to not be seen if you're trying to do something to the person who's in the light, you know.
Right.
Best wishes on all of that. I think you're going to be, hopefully everybody's going to be just fine in that regard. That, by the way, I would just say quickly, I mean, I know that it's easy enough to find that interview. That being said, I would encourage you to re-release it as a bonus. If it's easy enough to just plug it back into the feed, because I think everyone should go back and listen to that episode. And if it's just sitting right here for us, that would make it really easy. It puts a totally different spin on that conversation now that it's in a context that means something different to us or means something more to us.
Yeah, it's a good idea. Maybe if I have some time, I'll look that up and just drop it on a Wednesday or something for everybody to have.
Cool. I want to read this post from Joshua. I just thought this feels like, again, something that's going to come up certainly over the course of the season. But it's an interesting and thoughtful, because of everything we've talked about with respect to, you know, Black Lives Matter and the Defund the Police kind of campaign and all of that. As we're talking about under policing, you know, Joshua says, what do you think the happy medium between lack of policing and over policing is? For instance, if the police presence is increased in an area where teenagers are routinely known to carry guns illegally and the police are stopping them because they have a reasonable suspicion that they're committing a crime, how is this not going to be seen as racial profiling, especially when it seems like the area already has a distrust of the police department? Also, more interactions with armed people who don't trust the police could very easily lead to more killing of people by the police when they are encountering uncooperative people who are armed and known to be armed. Just curious on what you think the solution could be. And Joshua, I would just add to that, take away everything about whether who you're interacting with, having a gun or not, it's all unsafe. Like, as we've seen from so many situations, like just being in that community and being someone, whether you have whether you're armed or not, you could be in tremendous danger by the police because of this whole thing that has been created, this whole environment that now exists. Do you have thoughts on that? I mean, again, I'm sure we'll jump way more into that because we'll have to through the season.
Well, yeah, but it's definitely something to be thinking about from the beginning, because I certainly don't think that there's here's a real simple fix to this. There's not a simple, there's been decades of damage done here to get us to this point. And it may take decades to get us away from it. But one thing that Angelique said to me was, there's no community with the police. They don't have a relationship with the people and they don't trust them. So I think a good starting point is to start building some of that trust with the police, doing somehow getting into those streets, and maybe it happens. I don't know. It's not like I talk to everybody in the city, but I haven't heard from anybody that's had a positive interaction with the police, right? They're not cruising through the streets, stopping and talking to people and like developing relationships with the community. So I think that that's a part of it. This is not going to be fixed overnight, because the reality is there are some bad actors in there. I'm not here to say that like everybody in Benton Harbor are a bunch of really good people and they're only doing this because the police aren't there. There are certainly, in a lot of these cases, there's a handful of bad actors, But those bad actors kind of tend to hold everybody else hostage because they know that the police aren't going to investigate. It's the reason why you don't hear about murders in the arts district. Because if they go into the arts district and kill a white person or even, you know, just anybody that would be in that arts district, it's going to be investigated. They're going to find out, you know, they're going to put all their resources into solving that crime. But then you have Richard Perry gets shot in the head. And there's no effort at all. It's not a priority to them. So the bad actors that are there that would do that, they know that they can get away with it. They know that no one's going to tell the police who did it because they fear them, and which again cycles back around to because they know they're not going to do anything about it. So I don't know. I don't think it's over policing is the right answer. Like I don't think you can roll in there with tanks and that's going to fix it. It's not going to help the problem at all. I think that it's going to have to be a concerted effort to build community relations and build trust. And that's not going to be easy. I'm not sitting here telling you that, oh, all they had to do is just, you know, walk down the street and help somebody carry their groceries into the house and all of a sudden everybody's going to trust them. That's going to be a process. You've got years. And to be fair, this is years of damage. It was done way before Dan McGinnis was the police chief. This has been going on for decades, right? So I'm not sitting here like putting the blame on the current public safety director. But the situation is what it is, and somebody needs to break the cycle. Somebody has got to start moving forward to fix the problem. What that solution looks like, my hope is by the time we get to the end of this season, that you know we'll at least start taking some steps in that direction. Again, I don't want to fight. I will fight. Everybody listening to this will fight like hell. If we have to, we will. But that's not what I want. What I want is for us to work with the leadership and work with the community and maybe serve as a go-between, a liaison between those two, so we can try to get started on a solution.
Well, there are lots and lots of folks who are already asking how they can help. A little earlier, you said, you know, don't take any steps yet. We're very much in our very initial stages. Mm-hmm. So I think, but I would love to kind of wrap things up again, knowing that we have so many questions, but I think we've touched on the big themes that so many of these questions have been about. I just want to acknowledge Melody's post, who says, I've been a longtime listener and lurker on the Facebook page, but as a queer person of color, thank you so much for taking on this case and working to help Jody. Thank you for providing historical context to listeners to understand how residents of Benton Harbor are treated. And thank you for highlighting what many trans people in the prison systems face. I know we just started, and I'm looking forward to all future episodes.
Awesome. Well, thank you for listening, and thank you for your support. And like I said, we're going to have to, there's no way we can get to all these questions right now. We got a long season ahead of us. We got a lot of work to do. So we're going to go ahead and wrap this thing up, and I'm going to get right back in there to work on episode 2 put together for you guys on Sunday. So make sure you tune in Sunday. Thank you so much. And again, a big thank you to all those content creators that helped us get the word out about this. And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. Doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X at Truth Justice Pod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.